On Wednesday night, we're going to talk in our world religions class about the Muslim world, and we invite back all of you who have been coming and anyone who would like to start, because it doesn't matter on which night you come. I've been reading aloud from some of the sacred writing of the Hindu religion and the Buddhist religion. I've tried to pick out some of the noblest and most profound, because that only seems fair. And somebody came up after a class and said, if you had to choose only a few verses from our own Christian scripture, which ones would you pick? We hadn't time to pursue it very far. But one of the places that came to mind first was the paragraph Amy Lisey read to you a few moments ago from the first epistle of John. The one that says, God is love, and the person whose life is lived in love does in fact live in God. And God does, in fact, live in that person. Love contains no fear. Indeed, fully developed love expels every particle of fear. Those are extraordinary words, no matter what sacred scripture in all the world one is reading. I can't pretend to know everything the author had in mind, but those sentences are among the most provocative on earth, and we should think from time to time about what they might mean. I'd like to do that this morning, talk about fears and phobias, the ones that are relatively harmless, and the ones that cripple life, and a little bit about how it is that love manages to get rid of so many of them. Let's talk about some of the well-known irrational fears first, and the grip they can have on us, even when we know they are not logical. You and I both know that a black cat's crossing in front of us has no rational link with bad luck. We know it perfectly well, and we can make jokes about it and laugh. And yet, mainly, I suppose, because it got into us so early in life, a remnant of the old irrational fear hangs on. We know there's nothing to it, but we'd just as soon not have it happen. Can you tell me that you have never in your life sped up a little in the car to beat the cat that was headed across the road, or walked the other way just in case? I don't believe in that nonsense, and I never think about it after it happens. But it must have a little irritating power over me, because I don't mind at all when the cat turns back. Or when I notice, have you ever felt this relief, that it's not all black? After all, it has two front feet that are white. So what other phobias hang on, I wonder, and clutter up my life, and are some of them more serious? Phobia, as you know perfectly well, comes from a Greek word which means fear, and life is certainly full of phobias. Most are harmless. Some of them even add a little welcome spice to our conversation. We make jokes about triskaidekaphobia and the people who won't register on the 13th floor or plan a picnic on Friday the 13th. But claustrophobia, that fear of cramped, tight places is not quite so funny, at least to some of us. I know how silly it is most of the time, but in my subconscious, it hangs on, and I wonder if somebody made me sit in a closet as a child. What I do not have is agoraphobia, fear of immense open spaces. I love them. But then I'd rather enjoy them from ground level. There's an ancient little fear of falling that still lingers from childhood. Now you can see already, if you're listening and thinking at the same time, that these kinds of fear are rooted in what is thought to be a threat to oneself. If one could pay less attention to oneself, if one were not so self-conscious, much of this fear would vanish. And that brings us back to the biblical statement that love casts out fear, because the essence of love is the denial of self and the surrender of self to an extent that is impossible for one who is not in love. The more two people love each other, the less likely they are to be afraid of what the other may do. I can't imagine anything much worse, but I know for a fact that there are partners in marriage who are actually fearful of what the other person may do in a given situation. To be delivered of that kind of fear, to trust implicitly and with confidence, is one of the greatest gifts life has for anyone. You notice in the verses from John that he never appeals to fear in order to get us to love, because that doesn't work. You can't frighten people into loving. What he does is appeal to love to dispel fear. I read this as a rebuke to any religion that tries to threaten us into being saved or frighten us into being virtuous. What that does is to create reluctant goodness. Goodness we have not really embraced. And that is why you can sometimes be so astonished at the malice or the cruelty of some person who never misses church, who is always talking about religion. Such a person may harbor a deep, secret resentment at feeling driven and coerced, and suddenly explode in mean-spirited vindictiveness. People who are good only because they fear punishment are not likely to be very compassionate toward those who have been delivered from that kind of fear. But like most other things in life, this is not a one-sided story. Some fears are sensible and healthy, and they protect rather than paralyze. There are streets it is right to be afraid of late at night. And there are certain chances you are right to be afraid to take in a car. A man explained to me not long ago why he had turned away from a certain temptation. I was afraid of how I would feel later. Somebody called fear the tax that conscience pays to guilt. And many of us know that a lot of fears vanish when we stop misbehaving. Fear can be a kind of alarm system. It may be the mark of high intelligence. How many times have you read of some tragedy, especially one involving young people, and said, "Oh, my, they should have known better"? What passes for a kind of macho courage is often no more than ignorance. I have the most vivid memory of a great ocean bay in Mexico where I arrived once with plans to go out and fish in a boat brought by a friend. His battered old cabin cruiser turned out to be just barely adequate. But when the natives looked it over, they were obviously appalled. One old salt who could speak English and knew a great many colorful cuss words warned us that Kino Bay was not a little lake, that we could die out there, that we absolutely must not leave shore without a radio and 5 gallons of fresh water for each person on board. I thought that was a little excessive, since we didn't plan to get out of sight of land until I went out for the first time in that furnace heat of 119 degrees and discovered that I was almost dehydrated after a few hours. I caught on then that if our motor had died and we had drifted for a couple of days, we would have been in serious trouble. My fear, in other words, grew in direct proportion to my knowledge. I was not afraid at first because I was too dumb to be afraid. The chief mate in Melville's great novel, Moby Dick, a man by the name of Starbuck, says he wants no man in his whaleboat who is not afraid of a whale. I think I understand his logic. Certain kinds of fear, of course, can be creative. People build schools because they are afraid of ignorance. They build hospitals because they are afraid of untreated disease. The American novelist Theodore Dreiser once saw the human derelicts in New York's Bowery District and said later that he was never able to get that sight out of his mind. "It caused me," he said, "to fear for myself that in due course I might land here in this region of forgotten men." It helped him to keep writing when he wanted to stop. But the word fear, like the word love, runs a wide gamut of meanings. It ranges from prudence to panic, from having enough sense to take on board the 5 gallons of water, to the little girl who came in from school after an air raid in Baghdad and said so naively, "Can't we go someplace where there isn't any sky?" At one end, life is not safe without fear. At the other, when it turns unrealistic and abnormal, it can wreck life. Hysteria without warrant, phobias with no basis in reality. Animals escape most of this because they lack that incredible human gift called imagination, which is responsible for our best and our worst moments. I'm a nature documentary junkie. And one of the fascinating things to me is that as soon as the lion makes his kill among a herd of terrified impala or zebras, they all settle back down and start grazing again while he munches on one of their cousins. They operate on instinct and not on imagination, and instinct tells them that they're all right while the lion is at dinner. But along comes a new creature with something called imagination. She could picture danger to herself all day and night. Her mate could rehearse in memory the scare from last week and be terrified all over again. He could anticipate the one that would come next week, and if he weren't careful, turn into a phobia-ridden worrier who couldn't get anything done for fright. Oddly enough, the best cure for the morbid imagination, and there are more people who have it than you might guess, the best cure for that morbid imagination, which I remind you, is an obsession ultimately with self, is to become the captive of love and caring. So much that you don't have time for that morbid imagination. I read this case history from a mother of six children. She said, "As a young woman, I was troubled with many fears, which one of which was the fear of insanity. After my marriage and the birth of our first child, these fears still persisted. However, we soon had another child and ended up by having six. We never had much money, and I had to do all my own work with practically no help. Whenever I started to worry about myself, the baby would cry, and I would have to run and look after him, or the children would quarrel, and I would have to straighten them out, or I would suddenly remember that it was time to start dinner, or that I must run out and take in the wash before it rained, or that the ironing had to be done. My fears were continually interrupted by concerns about my family until gradually they went away and I look back on them with amusement." Love that is fully developed casts out fear. So our scripture said. I read a newspaper story once about a boy whose girlfriend was attacked by a grizzly. The boy had a chance to run, but when he saw the bear gnawing at the girl's neck as she lay on the ground, he forgot even the powerful instinct for self-preservation. In an action that defied all logic, he threw himself on the back of a 7-foot, 500-pound bear and began stabbing it in the neck with a rather small and inadequate knife. When the bear jerked its head back in sudden reaction to the stabbing, that single action knocked the knife out of the boy's hand and broke his arm. He was hideously mauled before help came, but he lived. And the girl's wounds were slight because the bear had turned its attention to the boy. What he did was totally irrational. Everyone would have understood the good sense of his running immediately for help. But there is something magnificent in the discovery that love can cast out fear even at a time like that when every nerve is screaming, your only sane hope is to run. We're often told that humanity's strongest and most basic impulse is survival. It isn't always true. We love someone and we forget ourselves. And that is exactly why love, slowly but surely, casts out all the foolish fears that make us sick, by teaching us to forget ourselves, to be so concerned about our child or somebody else's child, about other people and great ideas, that we simply no longer have time to think about ourselves. Love leads us inexorably into a world where we find the ultimate happiness. Find it for a very good reason. Because we have escaped, through love, the tight little prison of self. To live that way, the apostle said, is to live in God. I think he knew something.